Prodigal Summer, Disc 8.
The grass laid a cool dampness between the soles of her feet and her rubber thongs. She moved herself along the bank until the moon's reflection hung dead center in the pond, a white, trembling promise as old as night. She felt the enormous sadness inside her waking up. Sometimes it slept, and then she could pretend at life, but then it would rise and crowd out anything else she might try to be, hounding her with the 100 simple ways she could have saved him. He'd had a cold that day. He could have laid off, declined to take that trip over the mountain. If she'd been a better wife, she would have kept him home. "Cole," she said out loud, just to put the round word in her mouth, but then she regretted it because it summoned his presence so fully that her heart began bleeding out wishes. "I wish you were here tonight. I wish I could have back every minute we wasted being mad at each other. I wish we'd had time to make a baby together. I wish..." "Psst!" She turned her head. The wall of the barn that faced the moon was whitewashed in light, but she couldn't see anything else. She smelled smoke, though, then saw the red bouncing ball of a cigarette's lit tip. She wiped her eyes quickly, though it was quite dark. "Who is that?"
"Me," came a whisper. "Ricky."
"Little Ricky?" Her co-conspirator. She walked toward him, navigating carefully around the marshy spots at the edge of the pond. "Did you see what I got?" she asked him, trying to be glad about this distraction from her self-pity. "Did you check out my field above the tobacco bottom when you drove in?"
"Shh!"
His hand closed around her wrist in the darkness, and he pulled her around the corner of the barn, into deep moon shadow. "What are you doing, being a bad boy, smoking behind the barn? Here, look how bad I'm being." She held out the bottles, which he refused to sample.
"Phew, that hooch of Uncle Frank's is nasty."
"You think? I was just about to decide I liked it."
"That means you're skunked."
"Possibly. Who on earth are you hiding from?"
"Mom."
Lusa laughed a little. There was no end to family charades.
"Your mom, the queen of camels? From her you're concealing your evil habit?"
"Not mine, yours," he said, lighting a cigarette and putting it in her hand. Lusa frowned at it for a few seconds, then put it to her lips and inhaled. After a few seconds, she felt a pleasant, tingling rush running through her arms and under her tongue.
"Uh-oh," she said. "I'm liking this. You are a very bad influence. Did you see my goats?"
"Yep, look like about 40 or 50 up there."
58, I'd like you to know, and not one of them previously pastured with a buck. They've got one now, though, you better believe. If he gets busy and does his job, I'll have 50 suckling kids in time for Eid al-Fitr and my new barn roof paid for."
"Dang, that's something. All from just that one ad in the paper?"
"My telephone ringer broke, Ricky. I swear I'm not kidding. That's how much it rang. Have you ever heard of a telephone wearing out? I was in the pickup truck pretty much dawn till dusk all last week."
"Yeah, Aunt Mary Edna said she seen you coming in and out. She probably knows how many trips. How much you have to pay out total?"
$1.65 for the ad is my total investment so far. Goose egg for the goats. You wouldn't believe how thrilled people were to give me these animals. You'd think I was hauling toxic waste off their land."
"You can thank Mr. Walker for that. He's like the granddaddy of all the goats in this county."
"I do thank him. I did. I called him up on the phone. He was very nice."
"Nice, huh? That's not what they used to call it up at school."
"Well, I think he's a swell old guy. Totally helpful. You know what he told me? Sometimes you have to rub the buck with a rag and then dance around waving it in the girls' noses to turn them on."
"Oh, yeah," Ricky said, nodding slowly. "I believe I heard about that down to Old Black's. Somebody said they seen you up here doing naughty things with goats."
Lusa got elderberry hooch in her nose when she laughed.
"They did not."
"Oh, okay. My mistake."
He smoked and gazed out at the field. The grass looked white in the moonlight, as if touched with hoarfrost.
"Would that really help, you think? I mean, why would it?"
"Pheromones," she said.
"What's that?"
"Smells. A whole world of love we don't discuss. Huh, he said. So, 58 does. Think you'll get 50 kids out of them?
You bet. And you know what else? You won't believe what else.
What?
Over in the little pasture where I used to keep the calf, $3, my backup men. And in the old pasture, the one behind the orchard that's gotten way overgrown with briars, guess.
What, more goats?
71 does.
Shit, girl, you're in business.
Looks like it. Those are all does that have been pastured with a buck at some point recently, or that people couldn't be sure of. Mr. Walker said not to take them since I couldn't make them come into season right away, but I thought, why not just take them and keep them over there? In October, I'll turn my boys loose on them, and then I'll have my second batch of kids born and fattened up in time for Greek Easter and Eid al-Adha. Rick whistled.
You've done your math.
A regular goat-breeding genius, she tapped her head. You're not supposed to count your chickens before they hatch, but I talked to my cousin already, the butcher. He's so excited you wouldn't believe it. He's going to start taking orders in September. He thinks we can make a killing.
Yeah? How much?
Well, not a killing. Enough. Enough to cover the big stuff, the barn repairs I need to get done right now, for instance.
Per pound, what are we talking about?
$1.60, maybe $1.75? She had no real frame of reference for this price, but Ricky evidently did because he whistled approvingly.
Whew, man, that's good.
He grinned at her. Her eyes were fully adjusted to the darkness, and she could see him clearly, not exactly a carbon copy of his father, but with exactly the same gleam in his eye. She turned up her bottle and let the tail end of the serpent bite her tongue.
Look, he said, pointing up toward the moonlit hillside.
She could see the pale, humpbacked shapes of her goats spread evenly over the pasture, the way a child would put them in a drawing. Eventually, her eyes made out something else, the movement of the dark billy. He was working his herd, methodically mounting one doe after another. Lusa watched in awe.
You go, boy, she cheered solemnly. Make me a new barn roof.
Rick laughed at that. She looked up at him. Have you ever noticed what goats do in the rain?
Yeah, they get all hunkered up into a horseshoe shape.
It's the funniest thing. I never knew that before. Yesterday morning when it was pouring rain, I looked out my window and I thought, this I need. All my goats have come down with polio or something. But then as soon as the rain stopped, they all straightened out again.
Just goes to show you, you never pay much attention to a goat till he's fixing your barn roof for you.
How right you are, my friend. The moon was high now and smaller, and she felt her grief shrinking with it. Or not shrinking, never really changing, but ceding some of its dominance over the landscape, exactly like the moon. She wondered why that was, what trick of physics made the moon appear huge when it first came up, but then returned to normal size after it disentangled itself from the tree branches. In its clear light, she watched her goats hard at work, increasing themselves. She felt that Cole would approve of her ingenuity. But for the first time in all her plotting, she also now felt a twinge of sadness for these mothers and for their babies, who would all come to naught, at least from a maternal point of view. Yes, it was food, and people needed food and their merry feasts. But from this end, it seemed like so much effort and loss just to repair a barn and pay off some debts on an old, sad farm. For the 100th time, Lusa tried and failed to imagine how she was going to stay here, or why. When she tried to describe her life in words, there was nothing at all to hold her in this place. And words were all she could offer over the phone to her father, to Arlie and her other friends, to her former boss. Less than a year, she was starting to say. I'll be out of here. But there were so many other things besides words. There were the odors of honeysuckle and freshly turned earth, and ancient songs played out on the roof by the rain. Moths tracing spirals in the moonlight. Ghosts. Rick, she said. Do you ever see ghosts?
You mean real ones?
As opposed to imaginary ones? She laughed.
I guess that means no. Sorry, I asked. Why? You been seeing ghosts? They're in my house. It's full of them. Some are mine, people from my own family, my dead grandfather specifically, and some are your family. Some I can't identify.
Scary.
No, that's the funny thing, is they're not. They're all really happy. They're good company, to tell you the truth. They make it seem less lonely in the house.
I don't know, Lusa. Sounds a little bit cuckoo.
I know it does. He'd used her name. No one else in the family did, ever. And he had not called her Aunt Lusa. Whatever this meant, it stopped the conversation for a minute. Well, she said finally, I just wanted to tell somebody. Sorry.
No, it's okay. It's kind of interesting. I never seen any ghosts, but I never seen Alaska either, and it's probably up there.
That's a sensible philosophy.
What do they look like?
She glanced at him. Are you really interested? He shrugged.
Yeah.
They're not like in the movies. They're like actual people in my house. Kids, to be exact. Mostly they play on the steps. This morning I heard them whispering. I got up and looked down over the banister, and they were sitting there on the second step from the bottom with their backs to me.
Who was?
Now he was interested. Promise you won't tell anybody this.
Cross my heart.
Cole and Jewel. A boy and a girl, and that's who they were. About 4 and 7 years old, maybe.
Nuh-uh. You sure?
Yes.
You never knew Cole when he was little, though,
he pointed out.
She gave him a look.
You're questioning my scientific accuracy? They were ghosts. I don't know how I knew it was him. I just did. I've seen pictures, and you know, or maybe you don't, but when you've been that close to somebody, you can learn to know their whole life. It was him, okay? And your Aunt Jewel, brother and sister. She had her arm around his shoulders like she meant to protect her kid brother from the whole big world, like she knew she'd lose him someday. All of a sudden, I understood this whole new thing about both of them, how close they'd been. And I felt really sad for Jewel.
Everybody feels sad for Aunt Jewel. Talk about getting the short end of the stick.
What, because her husband left her?
Yeah, Uncle Shell hitting the road, and then Cole dying, and her kids being messed up, and now getting sick.
What sick? How sick?
I don't even know. Honest to God, they don't tell me anything. They act like I'm a little kid, but I have eyes. I can see her hair's falling out.
Oh, no, Lusa whispered, looking down. God, is it cancer?
I think so.
He touched his chest. She had that operation last year on both sides, but it still got all through her. Last year? After I moved here, or before?
I'm not really sure. It was all hush-hush, even in the family. Nobody knows down at church. Not even her boss at Kroger's. He'd probably fire her.
Lusa found no words. She could only shake her head from side to side.
Aunt Hannie Mavis has been taking her to Roanoke for these treatments. I only know that because she brings both their kids over for Mom and my sisters to babysit when they go. They never told me anything, really. I just put two and two together.
They haven't told me either, Lusa said. I knew something serious was wrong. Damn it, I knew that, and they won't even let me help. Her voice cracked. She felt flushed and weak-kneed from this awful news and feared that if she started to cry, she might not stop. He put his arm around her. Just from the simple comfort of that gesture, tears flooded her eyes.
They don't want to put more worries on you, he said. You've already been through the worst there is.
Not the worst. I'm still alive.
I think it'd be worse losing the person you love than dying yourself.
To her embarrassment, this made her cry helplessly. He was so young, how could he know that? She pressed her face against the cotton of his white t-shirt and the warmth of his chest and let herself stay there, sobbing, wishing she could fly away from here. In her mind, she could easily picture it. throwing things in a suitcase, books and clothes, practically nothing. She'd leave behind all the heavy family furniture, just run down the steps and away. But those two children were on the landing with their backs to her, impossible to get around. They stopped her. Rick had been standing silent for a long while, she realized, holding her patiently, stroking her hair with his other hand. She took a breath. "I'm sorry," she said, pulling her face away and avoiding his eyes.
"Don't be. It got my arm around you for a minute. I'd like to do more than that. I'd like to fix your whole barn roof."
He put his finger under her chin and, to Lucy's utter shock, leaned down and kissed her very quickly on the lips. "Rick!" she said, feeling some form of hysteria rise through her body. "Little Ricky, I'm your aunt, for God's sakes!" This was like a movie, she thought. The woman with no desire left in her, pursued for an evening by every man.
"I'm sorry," he said, really meaning it. He actually took a step back from her. "Oh, Lord, that was dumb. Don't be mad. I don't know what I was thinking, okay?"
She laughed. "I'm not mad. And I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing at me. You're a very handsome man. Your girlfriend is very lucky to have you." He didn't comment on that. He was looking at her, trying to guess what damage he'd done.
"You won't, like, tell anybody, will you?"
"No, of course not. Who would I tell?" She smiled, shaking her head and wiping her eyes with her palm. "Here's the really funny thing. Your dad was considering making the same pass half an hour ago."
"My dad? Him and you?"
"Don't act so shocked. Is that any worse than you and me?" But now he was angry.
"God damn, my dad? He didn't get anywhere, did he? I mean, what did he try?"
She regretted her indiscretion. She'd forgotten somehow that this was a child and his father. Lucy had no instincts for such things. She wasn't a mother. "He didn't really try anything," she amended calmly. "He didn't get past the planning stages."
"Man, that old lech," he said, shaking his head sadly. "And now look at him. He's up there jacking off in front of everybody with bottle rockets instead."
"You're very bad."
"I am.
But you're right. I guess I'd better go supervise the show so I can write up a good report for the insurance after they burn the place down." He touched her shoulder, stopping her. "Just don't be mad, okay? I like us being friends, Aunt Lucy. I'm sorry I messed up."
"Rick, I'm not mad."
She looked at her hands and clinked her bottles together, hesitating. She still felt startled by the taste of his mouth, the smoke and human pungency that had struck through her numbness into some living place at her core. "You know something? I'm lonely, I'm losing my mind, and it felt so good to have your arms around me, I can't even think about it. I should be thanking you. That's it. End of subject." She gave him a quick hug and left him there in his cloud of smoke. She mounted the hill slowly, amazed by the vision of lights opening out ahead of her. Hundreds of luminous fireflies were rising out of the grass while red and blue sparks rained down from the sky. All her sisters-in-law were busy feeding children or cleaning up, but the men were glued to their lawn chairs, hooting as the bombs went off. One after another, the missiles rocketed crazily out over the pond or into the catalpa tree, setting dozens of small hissing fires among the leaves.
"Oh!"
the male voices cried in unison when one misfired sideways into the grass. Then came a solid, beery cheer when the next one shot straight up with a loud hiss, popping open above their heads, flinging its sparkling seeds to the wind. Lucy bit her lip against the strange ache in her belly. This night was out of control completely, she thought, but what could you do? We're only what we are. A woman cycling with the moon and a tribe of men trying to have sex with the sky. Chapter 16. Predators.
"Huh!"
she cried aloud, jerking backward as if she'd touched electricity. That right there was a copperhead. Slowly, she pulled her weed hook back from the briars she'd been clearing away from the edge of the trail. In one slow, steady motion, she brought the tool's handle up to rest on her shoulder while the rest of her body held perfectly still, catching up with its lost breath. Not all snakes did that to her anymore. She'd seen enough of them now to conquer the instinctive recoil. Normally, when a slender-headed snake raced underfoot, a dark nose tapering to body in a streamlined profile, her mind instantly recognized a friend. But a triangular head made her go cold. Like a yield sign, she'd thought once before, only here in the woods it means stop. Here, every bird and mammal knew that shape advertised a venomous status, the profile common to pit vipers in general, and copperheads in particular. This one, sunning itself at the trail's edge, was especially fat-bodied, marked in a diamond pattern like a long argyle sock in coppery hues of brownish pink and deep rose. They were beautiful colors, but they did not add up to an appealing creature. "Easy, stand your ground," her dad would sing in a low monotone. The first copperhead of her life they'd found in the barn, coiled under a hay bale they were fixing to carry outside for the cattle. She'd yelped and darted for the loft door that once, but never again. "You can't run away till you know where away is. You could be headed straight for his maw." Now she kept her boots planted as she watched this fellow coil lazily over himself, headed in several directions at once, in no hurry to choose a course. She breathed deeply and tried not to hate this snake. Doing his job was all. Living out his life like the thousand other copperheads on this mountain that would never be seen by human eyes. They wanted only their one or two rodents a month, the living wage, a contribution to balance. Not one of them wanted to be stepped on, or, heaven forbid, to have to sink its fangs into a monstrous, inedible mammal 100 times its size, a waste of expensive toxin at best. She knew all this. You can stare at a thing and know that you personally have no place in its heart whatsoever, but keeping it out of yours is another matter. Finally, the wide-jawed head nudged out of the sunlight into the tall grass. The body elongated and followed in a sinuous line, flowing downhill. Shortly the head reappeared, tongue flickering, 10 feet away, in another patch of sunlight. The fixed line of its mouth ran back from the blunt nose in a little upcurve, like an ironic smile. It was just an illusion created by the deep jowls with the fangs tucked inside, she knew, but it filled her with sudden emotion. The fear and anger and queasiness in her stomach made her feel weak, but there it was. She hated the thing for its smile. "You stay there," she said to its unblinking stare. "Wipe that grin off your face." She turned and headed uphill toward the cabin with the stout scythe balanced over her shoulder. Her legs felt as heavy as water. There was no reason to feel this tired, except maybe the aftermath of an adrenaline rush, but she was ready to quit for the day. Eat a late lunch, curl up with a book. Rain was coming. She'd heard unexpectedly loud thunder several times already this morning. Each boom had made her jump, as the snake had. A storm rolling in from Kentucky. She took a shortcut back to the jeep road through a 10-year-old clear cut that was overgrown now but still sunny and full of cockleburrs. She tried to avoid this route in summer so she wouldn't have to spend an hour afterward picking the burrs off her jeans, but she didn't want to get caught in the storm. She swiped her weed cutter at the dense stands of bristly seed pods, taking her own perverse satisfaction in their presence, here and everywhere. Parakeet's revenge was how she liked to think of them. They'd co-evolved with an expert seed-eater, the Carolina parakeet, which had gone extinct so soon after Europeans settled that little was known about it but this one thing, its favorite food. John James Audubon painted the bird's portrait with their mouths full, feasting among cockleburrs, and he wrote of how the bright flocks would travel up and down the river valleys searching the burrs out, descending noisily wherever they found the bristly stands and devouring them until hardly any were left. That was hard to imagine, a scarcity of cockleburrs. Now they went uneaten, and would continue so for the rest of time. Now they grabbed the ankles of travelers and spread into fields and farms, roadside ditches, even woodland clearings, trying to teach a lesson that people had forgotten how to know. She picked up her step when the first fat raindrops began to spatter through the leaves. An hour ago, she'd been sweating, but as the storm moved in, she felt the air temperature plummet as if she were swimming deep into a lake. She stopped to untie her windbreaker from around her waist and put it on, pulling the hood forward to her eyebrows before taking off again at a trot. By the time the trail met the Forest Service road that ran up from the valley, she'd picked up her pace to a dead run. She slowed down on the road because its ruts could turn an ankle, and because the mountain was steep, she needed to catch her wind. Why did people always run in the rain? She still had half a mile to go, so she'd be soaked when she got home, regardless. She smirked at herself, then stopped to listen. It was a vehicle. She stood waiting for it to round the corner so she could see what manner of human intrusion this was to be. Sad to say, she assumed people meant trouble. She knew the Forest Service wouldn't approve of her inhospitable outlook, but this mountain would be a superior place if people stayed off it altogether. She waited, feeling her shoulders tense up, and was surprised when the flat green flank of the Forest Service Jeep appeared through the damp tree trunks. Today? What was it, July already? She thought about this. Yes, well into the first week of July. Darn it, they'd sent up her supplies and she'd missed what's-his-name again. Jerry Lind was his name, the guy who usually drove up with her mail and groceries. She needed to give him her requisition. Her heart was pounding, and not just from running uphill. Eddie Bondo was up there. This morning she left him sitting on the porch in his bare feet reading her field guide to the eastern birds. Oh, hell. Hey, Deanna, you look like the Grim Reaper. Jerry was driving with his head stuck out the open window. Hey, Jerry, you look like Smokey the Bear. He touched his hat brim. Keeps the rain off. He cut the engine, slowing to a roll next to Deanna, and then pulling the brake on hard, causing the whole vehicle to jerk. The road here was deeply cut with ruts that were starting to run like small chocolate rivers. She cocked her left foot up against the Jeep to tie her soggy bootlaces. What'd you do with my stuff? Just plunk it down on the porch stoop? Nah, I put it inside. With rain coming, your mail's on the table with the food boxes. I put your bottled gas for your stove on the porch. She studied him for some sign of what he'd discovered at the cabin. You run into any trouble? She asked cautiously. What, you mean that door? I'd say so. Those hinges are 90% rust. You got any WD-40 or should I bring you up some next month? That was all he'd run into? Trouble getting the door open? She watched his face. I got all, she said slowly. I do have a list for you, though, for next month. I need some lumber to patch up a bridge, and I've got a list of books I need. Jerry shifted his hat and scratched his forehead. Man alive, more books? Don't you ever want, like, a TV? A TV that runs on batteries? Don't tell me they make such a thing. I don't even turn on the radio I've got. You don't listen to the radio? Man, the president could get shot or something and you wouldn't know it for a month. She dropped her left foot and hiked up her right to retie her other bootlace. Tell me something, Jerry. If the president got shot this afternoon, what would you do tomorrow that'd be any different from what you'd do if he hadn't? Jerry considered the question. Nothing whatsoever, except probably watch a bunch of TV. On CNN, see, they'd tell you every 15 minutes that he was still dead. Why, I like my life, Jerry. I watch birds. They do something different every 15 minutes. Get in, he said. I'll drive up and get your rec list. I promise I won't tell you any news from the world. All right. She walked around behind the boxy metal truck to climb in on the passenger's side, tossing her weed hook onto the floor behind the seats with a loud clang. What were you going to do if you didn't run into me? Just repeat last month's requisition? Wouldn't be the first time. The Jeep lurched forward in pulses as Jerry lifted his foot off the brake. The road was extremely steep. That's true, it wouldn't, she agreed. I'm still eating the rice you doubled up on me in November. What had he seen in the cabin? She felt embarrassed and raw, as if Jerry had seen her naked. She studied him for signs of his thoughts while receiving whiplash in small doses as the Jeep pitched downhill. Jerry seemed like his usual self, a kid, in other words. She resisted telling him to gear down and use the transmission instead of the brake. Who was she to backseat drive? She hadn't driven a car in 2 years. He squinted at the single-lane track. The shoulder dropped off steeply to the left while the mountain rose straight up to the right. I never had to backtrack on this road before. Is there some place wide enough to turn around? Not for about a mile and a half. Down at that farm's the first place it widens out. She shifted in her seat. Who owns that place at the bottom of the hollow? I guess you wouldn't know. I do, though. It's the Widener place, Cole Widener. Forest Service had to get a right-of-way through him when we rehabbed this cabin, before you came. She looked off to the side, thinking about it. Widener's, she said, nodding slowly. They got some kind of timber, let me tell you. There's some virgin stuff in there, I swear, right back up against our border. Every year I'm scared to death they'll discover what they've got and log it. It'd cut the heart out of some wonderful habitat, all the way up this side of the mountain. Hey, he died, I heard. Truck blew 2 tires on the same side at once and he hit a bridge piling or something. On 77, going over the mountain. Jerry, no news, you promised. Oh, sorry. That's sad, though. I wonder who that farm will go to now. They'll log it, I bet anything. That I can't tell you. Widener. What was his first name? You said it a minute ago. Cole, like old King Cole, except I heard he was pretty young. Cole. I'm trying to think if I knew him. I went to school with Wideners, but they were girls. Not a very friendly bunch, either, as she recalled. They came to school in handmade dresses and kept to their own company like a club. Don't ask me, Jerry said cheerfully. I know. You're from Roanoke, and you're 12. Yes, ma'am, that's almost right. 24, actually. So, he said, still rolling very slowly downhill. A turnaround? Oh, sorry. There's really no place reasonable. Your best bet here is just to put it in reverse and back uphill real slow. Jerry followed her advice, though it was tricky business to negotiate the road uphill and backward. Dang, he said repeatedly, driving with his body half turned around, frequently turning the wheels the wrong way. This is like writing your name in a mirror. You know what, Jerry, you could just park. I'll walk up and get my list. That's okay. Sit tight. I'll drive you. Deanna felt uneasy approaching the cabin. He'd missed running into Eddie his first time up, apparently, but good luck didn't strike twice. No, really, she said. I don't care to walk it. Stop here. It'll just take me 10 minutes. You don't care to, or you wouldn't mind? She looked at him, exasperated. Would you please just let me out? He continued his slow backward progress, letting one tire run off the road for a second. It'd take you an hour, and it's raining cats and dogs. What's wrong with you? You got the all-overs? What y'all doing, Jerry? Taking a college course somewheres in hillbilly English? My mamma says that. You've got the all-overs. She's from Grundy. Fine. I've got the all-overs from sitting here waiting for you to rear-end a tree or plow over the cliff. Now, will you just let me walk? No. She gave up. Fighting with Jerry to be allowed to walk in the rain seemed ridiculous. She faced forward and watched the road wind out in front of them like a film running backward in slow motion. Could he really be that blind? Even if Eddie Bondo hadn't been there, the cabin was full of him. His coffee pot on the stove, his pack under the bed. Come to think of it, there were very few signs. There was next to nothing. She relaxed. Hey, I met your boyfriend. What? He's pretty cool. I never met anybody from Wyoming before. What'd you do, interview him? He's not my boyfriend, Jerry. He's just a friend who hiked up to see me for a couple days. He's packing out tomorrow. Yeah, right. What? She asked. Nothing. He's packing out tomorrow. Well, Deanna thought, he might be, for all she knew. She shifted her legs. This Jeep wasn't built for tall people. Soldiers must have been short in World War II. Why does everybody assume boyfriend when a girl and a guy are friends? Jerry touched his fist to his mouth and cleared his throat. Maybe because of the 25-pack of rubbers laying on the floor by the bed? She turned to face him, open-mouthed, lying on the floor. Jesus, Jerry, that's none of your business. He's just a friend, okay? People see a single woman and think she's got to have a man hidden somewhere. Damn him, she thought. Why couldn't he have been gone? Last month, when Jerry brought the mail up here, he was gone. Usually he was gone. Last week he'd stormed out and stayed away for 4 days in the rain just because she'd looked at him wrong. Of all the days for Eddie Disappearing Act Bondo to get domestic. Okay, Jerry said. Whatever you say. Deanna stared ahead. He probably thought you were my boyfriend. Jerry blushed. Scary thought, huh, Jer? Gives you the all-overs, don't it? I didn't say that. Okay, just pull in here by the cabin. I'll run in and get my rec list. And don't you be telling the boss I've requisitioned extra food for a visitor, okay? Because I haven't. I'm not going to tell on you, Deanna. Government employees are allowed to have a life. At the office, I think they'd all be glad if you were shacking up with some guy up here. They worry about you. Oh, do they? They think you should come down on furlough more often. You've got about 100 vacation days saved up that you've never used. How do you know I've never used them? Maybe I'm on vacation right now. You live here, he said firmly. You work here. You take a vacation in civilization. TV, electricity, city streets, cars, honk honk, remember? Not my idea of civilized, pal. She slammed the jeep door and headed her long-legged stride toward the cabin. She flung open the door with no heed for its rusty hinges and stood for a second inside the doorway, glowering at Eddie Bondo in his blue corduroy shirt, unbuttoned. He was reading, leaning so far back in the chair that it was balanced on its two hind legs like a dancing dog. She pointed a finger at him. As soon as he's out of here, I got a crow to pick with you. Eddie raised his eyebrows. She snatched the requisition list off the desk and was out the door again. Through the kitchen window, he could see her out there standing in the rain, talking a mile a minute to the kid in the hat. She could picture how she looked to him. Her hood had slid off the back of her head, her hands flew as she spoke, and her braid hung out the bottom of her jacket, lashing at the backs of her knees like the tail of an animal setting off at a gallop. When she bent over to pull her long-handled scythe from behind the seat, the kid cowered as if he thought she might take his head off. Eddie Bondo would be smiling. She hung up her tools on the outside of the cabin with a hard thump while the jeep turned out and puttered down the hill. "What are you grinning at?" she demanded when she came back in. "I saw a copperhead a while ago making a face just like that." "I'm grinning at you, girl, just like that snake was. Should I chop you into pieces like I did him?" "Don't lie, tough girl. You didn't hurt a hair on his little copper head." She looked at him. "What, then?" "Nothing. You're just beautiful, that's all. You look like some kind of a goddess when you're mad." What did he think she was? Some high school girl he could sweet talk? Tight-lipped, she began to shove pots and pans around, putting away cans from the wooden crates Jerry had left on the table. She lugged the huge, mouse-proof canisters out from under the pantry shelves and heaved in the sacks of beans and corn flour. Eddie Bondo couldn't stop grinning. "I'm not kidding," she warned him. "I'm just about mad enough to throw you out, rain or no rain." He looked amused by this toothless threat. "What did I do now?" She turned around to face him. "You couldn't have gone out. You couldn't just step into the outhouse or something for 10 minutes when you heard the jeep." She stood with her hands on her hips, amazed, as if confronted with a fabulously unruly child. "For once, it didn't occur to you to disappear?" "No, it didn't. May I ask why I'm supposed to hide?" She went back to slamming cupboards. "Because you don't exist, that's why." "Interesting," he said, looking at the backs of his hands. "I mean here you don't. You're not a part of my life." She unzipped her parka and came out of it like a snake shedding its skin, shaking out the full length of her miraculous hair. She hung the windbreaker on a peg, wrung out the end of her braid, sat down on the bed with a put-out sigh, and began unlacing her soaked boots. With one damp, wool-stockinged foot, she kicked the long string of condoms back into the darkness under the bed. "Jerry was impressed with your supply of prophylactics," she said. "Oh, I see. I blew your cover. Deanna, the virgin she-wolf, has her reputation to think about." She glared at him. "Would you put all four legs of that chair on the floor, please? I've only just got the one. I'd thank you for not breaking it." He obliged with a thump, closed his book, looked at her, waited. "Rainy day got you down?" he asked finally. "PMS? What?" The PMS joke made her wrathful. She had a mind to tell him the truth, that she was apparently menopausal. July's early full moon had snuck past her with no ovulation, and she couldn't even recall when she'd menstruated last. Her body was going cold on her. She tossed her boots at the door and stood up to pull off her soaked jeans. She didn't care if he watched or not. She didn't even feel like being modest. She was no virgin she-wolf, just an old woman with no more patience for keeping a boy around. "What reputation," she said, hanging her wet clothes on a peg near the stove and getting a clean towel out of the cabinet. "Other than Jerry and the guy who cuts my paycheck, there's hardly anybody who remembers I'm up here. I'm that far gone." As she toweled her hair, she bent over toward the wood stove. Her chilled-to-the-bone body was treating it as a source of warmth, she realized, even though there was no fire there. She also noticed he was watching every move of her naked limbs, taking in the long muscles of her thighs. "If you don't care what people think," he said, "then what's the problem? Why was I supposed to hide from young Smokey?" "He's not that much younger than you are. You're both just a couple of kids. Button your shirt. My God, it's freezing in here." "Yes, mother." He made no move to button his shirt. She stood up, hugging the towel to her chest. "Why are we playing house here, you and me? Do you know I'm 47 years old? The year you were learning to walk, I had my first affair with a married man. Does that not freak you out?" He shook his head. "Not really." "Does me. All of it does. That I spent 6 years researching an animal you'd like to see purged from the planet. That I'm half a foot taller than you are. 19 years older. If we walked down the street together in Knoxville, people would gawk." "As far as I know, walking down the street together in Knoxville is not in the plans." She sat on the bed in her underwear, shivering, feeling suddenly too exhausted even to sit up. She got under the blankets and pulled them up to her chin. She tried that out, looking at him sideways from the pillow. "As far as I know, there are no plans." "Is that a problem?" "No," she said miserably. He put his bare feet flat on the floor and leaned forward with his elbows on his knees. When he spoke again, he used a new version of his voice, quieter and kinder. "I guess we might seem like a weird pair to anybody who was looking, but if nobody's looking, there's no weirdness. I thought it was pretty simple." "If pride falls in the forest and nobody hears it, did it really fall?" He blinked. "What?" "You're ashamed of me," she said. "I'm ashamed of me, of us. Otherwise, we'd be able to walk down the street anywhere." He studied her face, seeming momentarily older, as if he could will himself into moments of maturity, she thought, but normally just didn't bother. He was 28, a juvenile male, like a yearling red-tailed hawk with his dark adult feathers just starting to show through. On the matter of mate choice, she was apparently addled. "Where I come from, people keep their treasure under the mattress," he offered finally. "They don't have to advertise it all over creation." "But if they keep it hidden, they never get to use it." "What is there to use about you and me? Where are we supposed to be spending ourselves besides here?" "Nowhere. I don't know what I'm saying. Forget it." He sat up against the straight chair back and crossed his arms over his chest. I know what you're saying. I'm really not all that stupid, my immaturity notwithstanding.
She lay still for a long time, looking at him from her prone position. His blue-green eyes, the exposed skin of his chest, the white bone buttons on his corduroy shirt, all of his planes and angles held a clear light whose beauty cut her like a knife.
Eddie, it's not like I want to get married and live happily ever after.
He winced a little, she thought, at the blunt mention of that possibility, even in the negative.
If you did, he said slowly, I'd be in Alberta about now.
Alberta, Canada? She asked. Or Alberta, Kentucky? Just how repellent are we talking about here? He stared at her, offering no answer. She shook her head.
You're not big enough to break my heart. I'm not some schoolgirl. Give me a little credit. But I'm not sure I can be like you, either.
What does that mean, like me?
Living with no plans at all? I keep bumping into walls.
She rolled onto her back, unable to look at him anymore.
When I moved up here, I thought I'd be just like the Phoebes and wood thrushes. Concentrate on every day as it came, get through winter, rejoice in summer, eat, sleep, sing hallelujah.
Eat, sleep, screw your heart out, sing hallelujah.
Well, yeah. She covered her face with both hands and rubbed her eyes. The birds were getting a lot more action than me. But you know what? Turns out they do have a plan. I'm an outsider. I'm just watching. They're all doing their own little piece of this big rowdy thing. Their plan is the persistence of life on Earth, and they are working on it, let me tell you.
You're persisting?
In a real limited way. When I'm dead, what have I made that stays here? A master's thesis in the UT library, which 11 people on the face of the earth have read or ever will.
I would read it, he said. So, 12 people.
You don't want to. She gave a short, unenthusiastic laugh. It's the last thing you'd ever want to read. It's about coyotes.
What about them?
She turned her head to look at him. Everything about them. Their populations, how they've grown and changed over time. One of the things it shows is how people's hunting them actually increases their numbers.
That can't be.
You wouldn't think so, but it's true. I've got 100 pages of proof.
I think I ought to read that.
If you want to. It'd be a nice gesture.
A gift before parting, she thought.
She turned back to the ceiling and closed her eyes, feeling the distant pressure of a headache coming on. His reading it, or not, wouldn't buy her a place in the scheme of the planet. She pressed her fingertips to her eyelids. Maybe it's my age, Eddie. You've got more time to pretend your life is endless before you face up to the bigger picture. He didn't ask her about the bigger picture, and he didn't get up and walk out the door. He asked if she would like him to make a fire, and she said she would. Her body was shivering visibly. She pulled the blankets over her head, leaving a small window through which she could watch his careful, steady hands place kindling inside the stove. She thought about the things people did with their highly praised hands, made fires that burned out, sawed down trees to build houses that would rot and fall down in time. How could those things compare with the grace of a moth on a leaf, laying perfect rows of tiny, glassy eggs? Or a Phoebe weaving a nest of moss in which to hatch her brood? Still, as she watched him light a match and bring warmth into the cabin while rain pounded down overhead, she let herself feel thankful for those hands, at least for right now. When he climbed into bed beside her, they held her until she fell asleep.
You're getting sick, he told her when she opened her eyes again. She sat up, groggy and unsure of the time of day. He was up and dressed, shirt buttoned even, working at the stove. He'd hooked up the new bottle of propane, a regular handyman.
What time is it? She asked. What do you mean I'm getting sick?
You sneezed in your sleep 4 times. I never heard anybody do that before.
She stretched her limbs, feeling very tired and a little achy from the weed cutting, but nothing else. No headache. That threat had passed.
I think I'm okay.
She inhaled the rich, convivial scent of onions frying in oil, something wonderful. Occasionally, it took all her wits to resist loving this man. She thought of coyotes. That helped. Something big enough to break her heart. "You sneezed in your sleep," he insisted. "I'm going out to get some more firewood." He dumped two handfuls of chopped vegetables into the pot, poured in water from the kettle, and settled the iron lid on it with a happy little ring. "Is it dark? Wait, what time is it?" She scratched her scalp and squinted at the window. "Dusk. Why?" "Be careful about the Phoebe nest on the porch. Don't scare her off the nest. If she goes off this late, she might stay off all night and the kids'll freeze." "It's not that cold out. It's July." "For a featherless little quarter ounce of bird, it's cold out. They'll die overnight if she's not on 'em." Eddie seemed to have trouble believing in the summertime cold up here, what people called blackberry winter. But he knew the truth of her warning, that a bird chased off its nest at dusk wouldn't come back. She might sit 50 feet away from it, crying out to her babies all night, stranded. Deanna had never known exactly why, but Eddie had told her what a hunter knows about animal perceptions. Most birds can't see in the dark. From 1 minute to the next, at dusk, they go blind and can't see at all. He smiled at her from the doorway. "I don't need 4 dead babies on my conscience on top of all my other sins." "It's important," she persisted. "I know it is." "It is. She's already lost one brood thanks to us tromping around out there." "I'll be careful," he said. "I'll tiptoe." He did, apparently. She didn't hear another sound until he came back in and stoked up the fire. She felt the mattress shift when he sat down on it, heard the hiss of the match, and smelled its sulfur when he leaned over to light the kerosene lamp on the table beside the bed. "Roll over. I'll rub your back where it hurts." "What'd you do? Eat some Mr. Nice Guy mushrooms?" She opened her eyes. "How do you know my back hurts?" "I'm always a nice guy. You just fail to see through my irritating demeanor." He kissed her forehead. "You're coming down with something. The flu or something. You felt hot as a furnace a while ago. Roll over." "The epizooty," she said. "Nanny used to say that. It's a catch-all disease category." She rolled over and lay with her face buried in the pillow, smiling, suffocating with comfort as he massaged her shoulders.
"Nanny was my dad's girlfriend," she said into the pillow,
which muffled her words completely.
"What?"
She turned over onto her back. "Nanny was my dad's girlfriend."
"Oh, I thought you said Eddie is a mad bird brain."
"Well, yeah, that too." "The apple orchard lady, I know. You got free apples and old dad got lucky." His hands moved expertly down her sides, working gently from rib to rib, but pausing just under her breasts and finally resting there, distracting her senseless. When she could no longer stand the suspense, he unzipped his jeans and got under the quilts. For a long time, he stroked her without speaking.
"So," she said, "you remember this junk I tell you about my life?" "She had a baby with a hole in her heart, but she wouldn't marry your dad."
"You do remember. I'm never sure if you're listening."
"No future doesn't mean I'm not here now."
She wanted to believe it, but couldn't quite.
"I don't know why you'd invest the effort," she said, "if you're just going to have to forget it all later."
"You think I'm going to forget you when we're finished here?"
"Yes."
"No." He kissed her for a long time. She kept her eyes open, watching. Kissing her with his eyes closed, he looked so vulnerable and yielding that it was nearly painful to see it.
"I'll forget you," she lied softly into his mouth, "the minute you're gone."
He pulled away from her a little, looking at her eyes to see what she meant. She couldn't focus as close as he could. That was age again.
"I'll make sure you don't," he promised. And she shivered, feeling the prescience of some deep change or damage. He would make sure.
The coyotes came unbidden to her mind, children in the woods, huddled in their den away from the storm. But Eddie Bondo's mind seemed to be here, focused on her, making amends for whatever hurt he felt he'd delivered earlier, The Alberta crack, she supposed. This was their strange dance. More than once now, she'd flown into a rage at him and then spent days afterward offering food, cutting his hair, washing his socks, her unguents of apology. It made her think of the bobtail cat she'd had in childhood that would sometimes get mean when they played and scratch her, drawing blood. Afterward, he would always hunt down a mouse and bring her its liver. Eddie had rolled on his side and propped himself up on one elbow, the better to uncover her body and look at it. It had taken some getting used to, this. She fought the persistent urge to cover herself with the sheet. "How come they never got hitched up?" he asked, tracing her aureoles with his index finger. "Your dad and his lady friend." "Nanny never did want to. I'm not sure why. I guess I admired her for it, though, for knowing her mind and wanting to be on her own. The county gossip was always that Dad wouldn't marry her. You girls always get the losing end of gossip." "Oh, you noticed. Yeah. And Nanny was kind of an odd bird. She still is. But he would have married her in a second. He was like that, just a plain honorable guy." "Unlike me." "Very. I think it turned him sad in the long run that she wouldn't marry him, especially after Rachel turned out so sickly. When she died, it tore everybody up. Dad was losing our farm at the time, and he just fell to pieces drinking. I'm sure it broke Nanny's heart, too, but she wore it better."
"And what about you? She was your sister, half-sister."
"Yeah, she was. I can't explain it, but I always knew she was going back to heaven. She'd just come to be my little sister for a while. Rachel was this angel. We'd play pirate ship, and I'd be the captain, and she'd be the angel. She was happy all the time. She had this kind of creamy skin you could almost see through. It was a local tragedy when she died." Deanna closed her eyes, feeling weirdly hollow inside from this talk. It might be a fever making her so loose and dreamy. "Nanny's tough, though. She's carried on all these years. She lives her life how she wants to, no matter what people say."
"So that's where you learned it from."
Deanna laughed. "Oh, boy, you should see what a mess I made out of life. I went to college and proceeded to go to bed with my professors left and right." He moved his body against hers, all of it, hard and warm and impossible to ignore.
"You were pursuing higher learning."
"Low learning. I don't know what I was doing. I think I had this daddy complex. I listened to my instructors. I married one of my instructors. He thought I was brilliant, so I married him. He said I talked like a hillbilly, so I stopped saying "it's party" and "once in a while." He said I should be a teacher, so I got certified and taught school in Knoxville and spent my 20s and half my 30s going out of my gourd.
"What did you teach?"
"Science and math and please shut up to seventh graders." While they'd been speaking, he had moved on top of her, supporting his weight on his elbows, and gently slid inside her without changing the tone of his voice or the conversation. She inhaled sharply, but he touched a finger to her lips and kept talking.
"No, I can't see you with an apple on your desk. I see you throwing chalk."
She lay perfectly still, catching her breath, as if she'd seen a snake. "Maybe I threw some chalk. I don't remember. I liked the kids sometimes, but mostly I felt like I was under siege." She spoke slowly and calmly, and it all seemed very secret, as if their bodies were hiding from their minds. "I'm an introvert," she continued carefully. "I like being alone. I like being outside in the woods. And there I was, living in a little brick house in a big city suburb, spending my days with hundreds of small, unbelievably loud human beings." He had begun to move inside her, unhurriedly. It took some concentration to keep her voice steady. She felt the corners of her mouth drawing back involuntarily, like the copperhead's smile. You'd think I could have figured it out, but I was restless for 10 years before it dawned on me that I needed to go to graduate school and study wildlife biology and get myself out of there.
And here you are. He held her eyes, smiling, while he slowly, slowly moved his hips. Her pelvis tilted, reaching for him. And here I am.
And you and the professor never had kids?
Oh, that was out of the question. He'd been married before. He had 2 teenagers already when I met him. The way he did the math, he and his ex-wife had replaced themselves. There was no more room on the earth for him to put another kid.
Wow, that's some pretty strict math.
He was like that, German.
But you hadn't replaced yourself.
I guess that wasn't his problem. He had a vasectomy.
And that was that? No regrets?
I'm not all that maternal.
He slipped a hand under the small of her back and pushed himself up very far inside her until she began to lose her train of thought. He had a way of reaching against her pelvic bone, creating a kind of pressure in a place no man had found before. Intercourse with Eddie Bondo was a miracle of nature. He held her there, with her back arched, and chuckled softly against her cheek.
You spend more time making sure you don't hurt a spider or a baby bird than most people do taking care of their kids. You're maternal.
He was still listening to her. She couldn't even remember what she'd said.
Shh, he said suddenly, tightening his grip on her and going perfectly still. What is that?
They listened to the soft sliding noise overhead in the roof boards. It was a dry, rough, papery scrape, almost like sandpaper moving through slow circles over a rough board. The sound had become nearly constant these days, in the evenings when the rain wasn't drowning it out.
It's not a mouse, Deanna conceded finally.
I know it's not a mouse. You always say it's a mouse, but it's not. It's something long and slidey.
Slidey? She asked. And you make fun of the way I talk?
Long and scaly, then.
Yeah, she said. It's a snake. Probably a big old black snake that came in out of the rain one day, hit the mouse jackpot, and decided to stay.
Eddie Bondo shivered. She felt him going soft inside her, and she laughed.
Don't tell me you're scared of snakes. You are.
He rolled off of her, throwing an arm over his face.
Why, my land's Eddie Bondo, a brave guy like you.
I'm not scared of 'em. I just don't like the idea of one crawling around above me while I sleep.
Oh, well, don't sleep then. Just lie here listening for it. Tell me if he's headed down here for the bed. Good night.
She leaned over, feigning to blow out the lamp.
Don't do that.
He struck a tone of true panic at the combination of snake and darkness. But then he grabbed her pillow and whacked her with it to cover his embarrassment. She let the lamp burn and fell back on the bed, delighted with herself.
Lady, he said, you are one mean son of a gun.
She took the pillow from him and settled it back under her head, relishing the upper hand. All her life in Zebulon County, she'd known big, husky men who worked dispassionately with fierce machinery and steers big enough to kill them, but who freely admitted to a terror of snakes of any kind. At 9 years of age, Deanna Wolf had made a legend of herself by bringing an 8-foot black snake to school.
It just does not make any sense to despise that snake up there, she told Eddie. He's on our side. I hate mice, is what I hate. Getting into my food, making their nest in the drawer so my socks stink like mouse pee, running over my feet in the morning and making me throw my coffee against the wall. If you took all the snakes out of this world, people would be screaming bloody murder at the rodent plague. Not just here, in cities, too.
Thank you, Miss Science Teacher. Too bad we're not all as logical as you are. You know what? He rolled over and whispered in her ear,
You're scared of thunder.
I'm not either.
You are. I've seen you jump.
That's a startle response, not fear. Thunder is nothing but 2 walls of split-apart air coming back together, which could not hurt a fly.
He lay back against the pillow beside her, grinning fiercely.
which causes you to jump out of your skin.
Mice make me jump too, but that's not fear, that's disgust.
Okay then, snakes aren't scary, they're just disgusting.
Foolish choices, Eddie. People make them every day, but hating predators on principle is like hating the roof over your head on principle. Me, I'll take one snake over 50 mice in my house any day. A snake in every roof.
He shuddered.
Snakes have manners, at least. They stay out of your way.
Stay out of my way, Eddie Bondo said to the roof.
Don't worry. She pulled the covers up and put her head on his shoulder. It was true that she had her own irrational fears. She spoke quietly, stroking the hard, indented midline of his chest and thinking of the cartilage that sheltered his heart. It's a single-minded predator, and its prey is not us. From a snake's point of view, we don't even exist. We're nothing to him. We're safe. They lay still for a minute, listening to the cricket music of a midsummer night. From somewhere nearby, she heard the quiet little chirping call of a screech owl. It was not the breathy hoot of the great owls, but a more private sound, a high-pitched, descending chuckle. She listened for the answer, and immediately it came, a series of soft, quick barks the little owls use at close range in breeding season. They were finding each other out there in the darkness, making their love right under the window. Deanna grazed the length of Eddie Bondo's collarbone with her lower lip.
So, she said, can we go back to our previous conversation?
I'm not sure. He lifted the blankets and looked.
Yes.
She rolled away from his arms just long enough to blow out the lamp. In a habit carried over from childhood, her mind whispered a prayer of thanks, as small and quick as the extinction of lamplight into darkness. Thanks for this day, for all birds safe in their nests, for whatever this is, for life.
This ends Disc 8.